Today, how will the current property mess play out? Hi again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, on this post covering finance and property news. Well, we've got some further data from Catalyst now to the end of June, which we want to talk about today, and also my latest data on mortgage and financial stress. So there's some really interesting questions to discuss with regard to what's happened with property and how it might play out ahead. To start the conversation, though, I wanted just to go back to this fundamental picture of the stylized view of house prices over roughly an 18-year cycle. This has been something which, of course, has been in the background for quite some time, and many claim it to be the way to understand the way that property works. We get a bit of a crash, a recovery, a correction, and then a boom. And most people who follow this model suggest that we are close to the end of the 13 to 18 year boom part of the cycle. But to an extent, this is driven not only by long-term issues, but short-term issues too. The long-term issue being land supply, but the short-term issues being a question of the supply of property, how much property is coming in. Also, the demand side, how much demand is there for property? And then, of course, you have government policy and how government policy is actually interacting with the market and with supply and demand. Now, the current outcomes that we've got is we've got $11 trillion in property across Australia. There's about $4 trillion in superannuation amongst households, $2.7 trillion in stocks and shares. And it's also worth noting that around 10% of the population holds more than half of the wealth in Australia, but 1% of the population holds less than 3% of all wealth. So it's not equally spread across the whole of the country. And that's a really important starting point for any conversation about what might be happening ahead. Now, as we think about this, of course, there are various ways of trying to take a reading on what's going on. Catalyst, for example, published their most recent results, and they say that values rose by 0.6% in June, marking a fifth straight month of growth. Now, as I've discussed previously, it depends on how you measure and where you look, and they have some aggregate measures, of course, across the whole of Australia. Over the past month, 0.6, past 3 months, 1.4, past 12 months, 3.4%. The combined regionals, 0.5% over the past month, 1.6% over the past 3 months, and 5.5% over the past year. And combined capital, 0.6 over the past month, 1.4% over the past 3 months, and 2.7% over the past 12 months. But of course, it does vary across regional and other centres. So for example, over the past 12 months, Canberra's hardly moved at all, 0.3%, whereas we saw movements very strong in Perth, up 7%, Adelaide up 8%, Brisbane up 7%, and almost nothing at all in Sydney, 1.3%, compared with a fall of minus 0.4%. On the other hand, Melbourne rose 0.5% over the past month, Sydney 0.6%. So it does move around quite a lot. I'd also make the point that the smaller areas like Canberra and Darwin are more subject to wide variation because they've got a very low population. Another way of looking at this, of course, is the trend. And you can see here that changes in rents have been moving up, but also coming back down a little, but they're still very extended at the moment. And it's also worth noting that gross yields are coming down a little thanks to the combination of price movements and also the question of rental returns. But these are aggregate averages. And one of the things that I keep reminding everybody is that you've got to go granular. And my old favourite here, North Ryde units, the 10-year trend, which isn't adjusted for inflation or anything, shows that the peak was actually in May 2018 at $1 million, up from 900,000 in May 2016. And in May 2025, the average price there, the median, is sitting around 750,000. And they've done nothing in the last 3 to 5 years, simply because of more supply and the fact that prices probably were overvalued. Now, the question is then, are those price indicators useful at all when trying to work out what to do with regard to property? Well, they're one indication, but I'm of the view that they are often misinterpreted, misrepresented. And remember, of course, that there's a lag between the data on sold property and it going through into the various registers and therefore become definitive. And quite often what I see is that the data therefore is more lag than people think, varies considerably from units to houses, and varies considerably location to location to location. So these high-level aggregate indicators, I think, are not very useful. Now, of course, the other thing that people turn to is the question of the clearance rates. And we had over the weekend this headline from the Fin Review: unlivable Sydney home sales for $2.5 million. The national auction clearance rate has risen to its highest level in a year after two interest rate cuts, and the possibility of more helped to boost buyer confidence. Now, the fact is that this is a bit of a skewed data point. Now, I made a show over the weekend titled Calling Out the Auction Clearance BS Again. It's worth checking that out if you've not seen it. But basically, if you look at the domain data, they look at the number sold versus the number reported, not the number listed. Whereas somebody like SQM has a different way of reading it. And you can see there that actually the clearance rates are somewhat lower. And as discussed with everyone on Monday, the truth is that the number listed are a little up from last year, but there's a big hangover of property that's been on the market for a long, long time, a lot of old investment properties. And so the clearance rates are not necessarily that indicative of anything much at all. Now, the other thing it's worth noting, if you're taking this national perspective here, the truth is that you can see markets where prices are going down. New Zealand, of course, being a classic example, where in fact prices are now down 16% from their peak back in 2021. And that was because they dialed back in migration and they also tightened some of the lending standards over recent years too. And interestingly, when you tighten migration and make some of those other changes, house prices react. Now, whether that's a good thing or not depends on whether you hold property or whether you're trying to go into property. But when you've got such extended property, the risks are very high, of course, when valuations are continually extended over where they should be long term. So in a way, a reversion to mean is certainly possible at some point, maybe. And just to underscore that, if you look at the other data point, which is again from CoreLogic and using RBA data, it shows you that the median home price across Australia relative to the capacity to pay is still pretty extreme. It's eased slightly thanks to the recent rate cuts, but the questions will be seeing many more. And it's worth noting, of course, that if you look at the latest credit sector data, the private sector credit was strong and credit for housing was up 0.5% across the month, which is, if you think about it, 6% annually, which is significantly higher than the inflation rate. That means that we are still leveraging up more and more and more into property. Or another way of looking at it is this chart that shows you the real residential property price moving in line with the Reserve Bank measure of liquidity. Also, it's worth noting that migration, of course, continues to be very strong, come back slightly. But if you look at the movements of population growth, they are still significant, particularly in Western Australia, 2.4% population growth over the last year. That's another reason why population growth is still pretty strong. So if you sort of put this together, what we can say is that there are a range of government policies that are driving some of this, like the migration. There are also issues with regards to the supply of property, which we'll come on to in a moment. But the demand is still strong. There are people still wanting to buy property. And some of that's migration. Some of that's more broad people coming into the market. The fact of the matter is, of course, that many households are under some difficulty. And as we saw in the latest retail statistics, again, there was a small move, but nominal retail sales growth has deaccelerated to 3.3% year on year, slumped to 1.8% on a 6-month annualized basis, according to Alex Joiner. And he suggested that could mean that the RBA is perhaps comfortable to cut in July, which may help, depending on the CPI. But it's worth noting, as Tarek tracked, the per capita resales growth continues to be negative. And of course, the nominal retail sales is driven by migration. And on the costs of living, it's worth noting here, you can see how the average recommended retail price for energy has moved over the last decade from 2015 to 2025 in New South Wales, from $36 to $256. And in Queensland from $31 to $169, and in Victoria from $34 to $264. One of the reasons why households in Victoria are under the pump. Now that, of course, is bad policy, thanks to the gas reservations and everything else. Energy is way too high, and it's putting huge pressure on households. Just something else to note is that on the demand supply perspective, looking specifically at the supply side, the dwelling approvals did move up just a little. According to Shane Oliver, the May building approvals were up 3.2% month on month, but still well down from recent highs. And it's driven primarily by the volatile unit approvals, which rose 11.3%, having fallen significantly. But if you stand back slightly, you can see here that the National Housing Accord is 60,000 below where it needs to be in the first year. Remember, we've got the 1.2 million target from government, and we're way off that at the moment. And of course, one of the consequences of that is we quite often see talk of high-density construction. Two Sydney suburbs here are talking about moving to 18 stories under a controversial council plan to deliver 4,000 new dwellings in Canterbury Bankstown and also Wylie Park and Punchbowl. And we're seeing this all over the place. But of course, as I've said before, it's worth noting that these high-rise developments are very expensive to build. In fact, the costs are so high at the moment. And of course, it changes the local characteristics of the area that you're in. And people perhaps don't necessarily want that in their backyard. Now, if you try and put all this together and say what's going to happen ahead, well, we're probably going to get another rate cut. It's a question of when. Could it be July? Possibly so. Most people are saying that the inflation barrier means that there is still opportunity, although I have to tell you that I'm less convinced than some, simply because the inflation is still somewhat stuck. Nevertheless, as I highlighted recently in my show about fibs and bribes and plain stupidity, we're seeing the owner grants for first buyers coming in. We're seeing the Queensland 2% deposit home loan scheme program as well, trying to drag more people into the market. And as I've argued and will argue till the cows come home, doesn't help. What it does, it allows a few people to get into the market, but it lifts prices higher and makes affordability worse. So where we are at the moment is that the conditions are in place potentially for some rate cuts. Conditions are in place possibly to see some price rises in some locations. But the fundamental structural issues that we have in the economy with too much migration, not enough supply, and too much demand haven't been solved. And it doesn't look as to me that the government is likely to solve it. And as I highlighted in a recent show, when I asked AI about the housing affordability question, there were some issues, particularly on migration, which the AI suggested was pretty important. And yet, of course, in practice, nobody wants to talk about that. The truth is that, of course, migration is regarded as a sacred cow. You can't even start talking about it, because if you do, then you're accused of being racist. And as this meme shows, we need to fix this housing issue, government grants, summit, cut immigration. And the poor chap suggesting cut immigration gets thrown out the window. That seems to me to be a pretty accurate state of affairs. You can't mention the migration question, despite the fact that migration is clearly a factor here. So as we sort of take all this into account, what I try to do then in my models is to try and understand what is really going on. And for those familiar with what we do, we take our surveys every month and we plug it into our core market model. And that allows us then to take a view of where things might be happening. And we can slice and dice the data lots of different ways, looking at different property types, looking at geography, looking at the master segmentation that we run as well. And we can form a view as to where prices might go ahead as well. Now, this is pretty important, particularly now, because, of course, everyone's saying, oh, it's going to get a lot easier. Well, I'm not as convinced as some. And in fact, in my latest modelling, I've looked at this. To be clear, when I talk about stress, I talk about cash flow, money in, money out. There are other ways of doing it, 30% of income or maybe underwriting metrics. But I think money in, money out is the way to do it. If households have more outgoings, maybe excluding discretionary items and income, we can define them as stress. If they have a mortgage, they're in mortgage stress. If renting, they're in rental stress. And we can look at investors as well. And we can also aggregate the data as a look at total financial stress. And we can look both in percentage terms and in counts. In many ways, the law of big numbers suggests the count is a more important measure. Now, the RBA published quite recently this spectrum of household financial stress. And they said at the mild end, you've got budget pressures, then you have perhaps missing payments and maybe insolvency. I measure it at the budget pressures end, at the mild end. This is where we've got households juggling priorities. Do they pay the mortgage? Do they pay the rent? Do they get health care treatment, or do they eat less? Those sorts of horrible trade-offs. And there is a bit of a journey between budget pressures and missing payments and insolvency, perhaps 3 to 5 years. And of course, the banks are doing whatever they can to try and assist by effectively extending and pretending, in other words, extending the term of the loan, going interest only, which allows them to keep the delinquency rates down. Although, as I showed recently in a post, delinquency rates are rising. So what does this all mean? Well, what I've done is to model the latest data now to June. And I'm just going to share today the top level data here. So this is to June 2025. And you can see, firstly, rental stress. Well, rental stress at the moment is still sitting at 75.1% of those in the rental sector. That means 75% of households in rent are struggling to balance cost of living and paying the rent. You can see it's come back very slightly, but it's still very high relative to where it was back in 2019, when it was around 28 to 30%. Looking at mortgage stress, here, half of households with a mortgage have cash flow pressures, 50.2% actually, and you compare that with the February 2020 data at 32.9%. So the takeout from this is that households are still under significant pressure, and those pressures, of course, are multifaceted. As I've touched on, it's the cost of living, it's the energy costs, and all of those other factors, as well as mortgage interest rates, which have come down a little, but of course, those cuts take time to propagate through, and they're still a lot higher than when many people took their mortgages out some years ago. Now, the bottom line, when you look at this in detail, is that you can see that across the country in June, highlighted in yellow, mortgage stress rose in the New South Wales state, Tasmania, Western Australia, and overall 50.2%. I'd highlight that Tasmania is still up there with long-term structural issues. Western Australia is also now significantly under pressure, and that's because of that high migration that I mentioned. Looking at rental stress, New South Wales has a very high rental stress at 81%. It's also high in Victoria as well at 71%. So it's also high as well in Victoria at 74%. It did come back very slightly this month, but it went up in Tasmania and Queensland and Western Australia, and the grand total accelerated. Investors are significantly under pressure. This is, of course, because some of the rentals are actually under significant pressure thanks to higher costs, but the growth of rentals are actually easing back slightly, as I showed you earlier on. So across the ACT, New South Wales, the NT, Queensland, South Australia, and Western Australia, and overall, stress investors are rising. We're still seeing more investors thinking about listing their properties. And the aggregate financial stress at 48.2% in the ACT, 51% in New South Wales went up, 45.9% in Queensland, 42% in South Australia, 44% in Tasmania, 46% in Victoria, did come down slightly this month, 46.9% in Western Australia, and 45.7% across the total of Australia. And translating that into numbers, 4.7 million households have financial stress compared to the 10 million that we have in the country. And looking at mortgage stress, 1.8 million households have some cash flow pressures in their mortgages. We have 2.3 million rental stressed households, and we have 527,000 stressed investors as well. So my point is simply this, that we do have some households doing it fine, no mortgages or very small mortgages, but we've still got a lot with difficulty, and the rental stress issues have not gone away. And frankly, the governments are doing very little, state and federal, to help alleviate some of the rental stress issues. The long-term affordability pressures that I see are going to continue. Now, what I will do is to run a live stream next Tuesday, where I'm going to go into this in more detail, and I'll start breaking down individual postcodes and suburbs. If you're interested in a particular data point, put a question in the comment below, and I'll try and include it. Before I go, I will just make the point that we run our scenarios too. Now, our scenarios are a way of trying to deal with what may happen. It shows sensitivity analysis. And there are three scenarios. Best case scenario is that we don't see significant rate rises from here. We see rate cuts. We don't get a recession in Australia. We start to see growth coming back, and the trade tariffs don't hit Australia too much. The baseline is a little bit more adverse insofar that rate cuts are slower to come, growth is slower, and we see unemployment tick up a little bit and migration come down again. And the third one is a more significant cut in migration. Rates don't get cut any less quick, and we also see migration easing away and we get a recession in Australia. So those are the three scenarios we use. And if we do that, what we can then do is to make sort of a top line view as trends over the next 3 years. And this is what we see. There is still a scenario where over the next 3 years, Australian home prices at an aggregate level continue to rise, and they could be up to 9.9% higher over the next 3 years. The baseline scenario is a bit of a fall, around 5% over the next 3 years, with the bulk of it not happening until a year or so away from now. And there is a worst case scenario, which would actually take us down around 25% over the next 3 years. That, of course, would still be into expensive territory, but just slightly less so. And remember that the scenario in New Zealand was a fall of 16% over that similar sort of time frame. And units, by the way, would follow on pretty close, although perhaps not quite fall as much in the adverse scenario. So the bottom line is this: we are seeing pressure on households continuing. We are seeing government stimulus flowing through into the housing market. We're seeing an expectation of lower interest rates and higher home prices. But it's very important to understand that not all property in locations will behave in the same way, and that's why it's important to go granular. And I'd also highlight again that the spruiking with regard to the clearance rates and even home prices have been turned up to 11 again. So it's really important to do due diligence and to think very granularly when you think about making property decisions, something which, of course, I focus on. And by the way, if you want a conversation with me about a particular postcode or suburb, I can do that through my one-to-one service. This is something that I've done for quite some time. The one-to-one service is really the only time that you can have an individual conversation with me and we can look at a particular area. I can't give financial advice, but I can dive into the data and look at the underlying trends. We can look at the stress data, the home price trend data, and also think about where things may go from here based on my modeling. This conversation takes about an hour via Zoom or phone, and there is a cost involved simply because it takes quite a lot of work from my end to put it all together. If you're interested, you can contact me by the DFA blog. Spaces are limited each week. We're booking 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment simply because of the number of people who are interested. But if you are interested in that detailed conversation, feel free to join that queue there. Or indeed, join me next Tuesday for my live stream and you can ask for specific information about a particular postcode. And I can show you the one-page summary for that particular postcode, which looks at things like stress levels and also the trends with regard to property prices. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.